Dutch government says it will not back down on its coronavirus curfew despite three nights of rioting. Russia says the U.S. must lift anti-Iran sanctions to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal more than 2 years ago. And Tunisians hit the streets again to protest social injustice and police abuses after more than a week of rallies despite a ban on gatherings. From Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, starting with Europe, in the Netherlands, the finance minister is saying that the government is not going to back down on its nighttime curfew to curb the coronavirus, despite three nights of rioting. Wopke Hoekstra says that authorities won't capitulate to people who smash shop windows, calling them scums. The protests initially sparked over the weekend after the government imposed a curfew. It turned violent, with demonstrators resorting to vandalism in different cities, including in Rotterdam and Amsterdam. Hundreds of protesters have been detained. At least 10 police officers were also injured on Monday night. The curfew, which has been described as the first in the country since World War II, also came amid fears of a new COVID variant first detected in Britain. The Netherlands has so far recorded 13,500 COVID deaths and close to 1 million infections. The EU could take pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca to court for a breach of COVID vaccine supply contracts if it does not honor its delivery schedule. And that's according to the Latvian foreign minister. He said that the possibility of taking the case to court should be evaluated and coordinated among member states. The EU has already ordered 100 million doses for the first quarter of this year. The bloc, however, is likely to receive only half of that amount. The British-Swedish pharmaceutical company has notified the EU that it could not meet the agreed supply target by the end of March. This has prompted the bloc to threaten the company with blocking its export of vaccines to countries outside of the EU, such as the UK. The International Monetary Fund has updated its world economic outlook. It says the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines will boost the global recovery in 2021. In a report, the IMF said that the world economy will grow by 5.5% this year. The economic activity will remain below pre-pandemic levels in the first two quarters, but vaccinations might boost activity levels in the second half of the year. The report also anticipates an economic rebound in China, the U.S., and Japan. However, it says that a new wave of infections will slow the economic recovery in Europe. According to the IMF, the 19-member Eurozone will collectively register 4.2% growth this year. That's a full 1% lower than what was predicted in October. In France, education workers have held rallies in major cities, including the capital Paris, to demand pay hikes and better working conditions. Teachers, other school workers, and students also joined the strikes on Tuesday over salaries and the government's handling of the pandemic in schools. A collective of unions approved the strikes, saying that there is a real anger rising among teachers who are very worried. Last week, students also took to the streets to demand the reopening of their schools and universities. They denounced their growing precariousness aggravated by COVID-19. That says medical experts are calling for a third lockdown amid a sharp rise in hospitalizations. France's total COVID cases have passed 3 million. Its death toll is nearing 74,000. Welcome to the News Review. The Iranian foreign minister and his Russian counterpart have called for the preservation of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. Mohammad Javad Zarif, who was speaking in Moscow ahead of bilateral talks, called for continued unity between Iran and Russia to save the nuclear deal from risks and fears that arose after the U.S. withdrawal. He also thanked Moscow for its efforts to keep the deal alive after the U.S. exit and for Russia's constructive and principled position on the accord. Meantime, Sergei Lavrov said that rescuing the agreement is one of the most pressing issues. Following talks between the two top diplomats, Zarif said that his discussions with Lavrov also focused on the ways to boost Moscow-Tehran relations.
As for bilateral ties, given the importance of the importance that the leaders of both countries attach to mutual relations, we made good progress, and today we discussed how to further cement bilateral ties in different sectors. In the area of energy, transportation, and in other areas, we held talks.
Zarif says the two sides also held constructive talks on cooperation in nuclear energy. Then Lavrov echoed Iran's stance on the U.S. return to the nuclear deal. He said that Washington must remove sanctions against Iran and comply with the agreement as a condition for Iran to return to its JCPOA obligations. Iran has started scaling back its commitments under the deal 1 year after Washington unilaterally withdrew from it. It says remedial measures are in conformity with the deal and reversible. Time now to get some insight on this. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have George Samueli, Senior Research Fellow with the Global Policy Institute from Budapest, and Fuadi Zadi, Professor of World Studies at the University of Tehran, joining me out of Tehran. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Over to Budapest first. Georgia, you just heard what the Iranian and also Russian top diplomats think about the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. How do you look at the situation? What's your assessment? What's going to happen?
Well, of course, Russia has been a very principled and consistent player in the JCPOA. The problem hasn't arisen on Russia's end. The problem has arisen at the United States' end. And I'm one of those who has been from the beginning very skeptical about the possibility of a U.S. Return to the JCPOA under any terms that would be acceptable to Tehran, because what the United States will demand is additional restrictions on Iranian activity. Now, the United States is not in any position to demand additional terms to when it has failed to fulfill its own terms. You can't have a new agreement when you fail to implement an old agreement. Moreover, the things that the United States is going to want from Iran, which is constraints on its activities in Syria, in Lebanon, and as well as constraints on its ballistic missile program, these are conditions that are absolutely unconditionally unacceptable to Iran, because these are issues that pertain to Iranian security. So I think Iran will then prefer to be out of the JCPOA and maintaining its strategic position in the Middle East.
Now in Tehran, let's go to Professor Izadi. U.S. is in no position to demand anything. I mean, is it because it was the U.S. that left the JCPOA? And Tehran is not just anxious to see the U.S. back. Tehran is just saying that if U.S. wants to go back, okay, lift the sanctions first, then you could sit at the negotiating table. Let's have your comment on that.
That's true. And you know, when President Trump left the nuclear agreement, Biden, people around Biden criticized him quite heavily. So it's logical, if they follow any type of logic, for them to go back to the nuclear agreement since they're sitting in the White House now. But it seems that they're not going to do that. That's the first option they have. They're not going to take it, it seems. The second option they have is to go back step by step. So they could say, we will lift this many sanctions, and then Iran's supposed to do this, and then the next step, and then the next step. And it seems they're not going to take that second option either. The third option they have is to demand Iran to return first, which is not logical, because it was the United States that left the agreement, and Iran stayed in the agreement for more than a year after the U.S. had left.
Exactly.
But the third option is that Iran returns first, they come and inspect, make sure that Iran is following the agreement, and then what they are saying is that they want some parts of the nuclear agreement changed, the sunset clauses, for example, they want to see extended and other things, and they are demanding for Iran to negotiate on its missiles program and regional influence. That's the third option. That's what they are saying now. Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, even Biden himself. And what the third option is not very different from Trump used to say. Trump used to basically say the same thing in a different terminology. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Iranian leaders will take the third option.
Okay, Georgia, isn't it the U.S. that should take the first step? I mean, if it wants to do anything regarding the JCPOA, because Iran has been in compliance ever since. And Iran is saying those remedial measures also could be reversible, but first it's the U.S. that needs to lift the sanction. Isn't that logical?
Of course it's logical, because it was the United States that withdrew and the United States that imposed sanctions and then secondary sanctions by putting restrictions on what other countries could do when they tried to do business with Iran. So to the extent that Iran has failed to comply with every part of the JCPOA, that is a direct result of what the United States did, because what the United States did was to prevent Iran from disposing of its enriched uranium. So Iran started storing more and more enriched uranium, which was no longer in compliance with the JCPOA. That's a direct result of U.S. action. It's not. Right. It wasn't the desire on the part of Iran to breach the JCPOA. So absolutely, the logical step should be United States drops its sanctions and returns to the JCPOA. But there's no way in the world that the Biden administration is going to do that.
Now, Professor Izzedi, you told us about the three options that you're anticipating. What about the Europeans? I mean, the signatories to JCPOA, forget about the U.S. Are they not going to take any action? They're just still waiting to see what's going to happen next?
You know, if recent history is going to help us to answer that question, the answer is that the Europeans either don't want or cannot stand up to the United States violations in different areas, including Iran's nuclear agreement. Obviously, there are only some European countries, there are differences between European countries on Iran issue, but there are three countries that have been part of the negotiations. UK, France, and Germany have not shown any indication that they can follow an independent foreign policy. And that's a problem that Europe has.
Right.
It's up to them to change that. Iran is not going to wait for Europe to make up its mind. Iran waited for Europe. You know, there was this idea that while the Trump administration is out of the nuclear agreement, Europeans could do something to make sure that the agreement does not fall apart. Mm-hmm. And Iran waited for that for about a year, and nothing happened. So that experience teaches Iran a lot of things.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. We had George Samwit, a senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute out of Budapest, and Fuad Izzedi, professor of world studies at the University of Tehran, who joined us out of Tehran. Let's take a look at India. Angry farmers have clashed with police in Indian capital during a protest against the government's agricultural reforms. Protesters breached barricades and attacked police after rolling into New Delhi with thousands of tractors. Officers fired tear gas at the violent mob rallying in the center of the city. Demonstrators chanted slogans against Prime Minister Modi and urged him to repeal the laws approved in September. The rally was launched after an annual parade marking Indian Republic Day. The government says the new legislation will boost rural incomes as it further opens up the agriculture sector to the free market. But farmers are saying the legislation will destroy their bargaining power and expose them to threats of big corporations.
There have been several number of talks. At least 11 rounds of talks happened between the central government and the farmers' union. Without all the talks end without any conclusion. So they had asked the permission from the government. So the police had given them a permission. But today the protest has turned a little bit ugly. There are reports that tear gas shells have been fired at protesting farmers, and several incidents of stone pelting has been happening in other parts, like Singhu border, which is nearly close to Delhi, at least 35 to 40 kilometers. There has been reports that thousands of people started converging as early as 8 a.m. in the morning and tried to surround the capital city of New Delhi. This is happening amid the New Delhi is celebrating its Republic Day today. So it looks like the farmers are adamant on their demands. Earlier, the government has agreed and told the farmers' union that they will put all the laws, the farm laws they have passed, they will put all the laws on hold. But the farmers' union denied everything. They said, no, we need a concrete solution. Maybe after some time, maybe after a year or 2 years, you will start passing this farm law again because you have the majority in the parliament. So we need a concrete solution. We need laws that will safeguard and secure our future, because at the end of the day, India is an agrarian country and 70% of its people are directly or indirectly connected to the farm sector.
In the midst of heightened security, internet suspension, and closed businesses, India is marking its 72nd Republic Day in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Our correspondent has a report from that disputed territory.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held the symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
After revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude. And the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio. in the limelight. Republican divisions over Donald Trump's second impeachment trial came into clear focus on Sunday, 24th of January, as the former president spent his first weekend out of office plotting revenge against those he says betrayed him. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled Trump Plots Revenge on Republicans Who Betrayed Him as Senate Trial Looms. Stay with us for more of Richard Luscombe's article. Republican divisions over Donald Trump's second impeachment trial came into clear focus on Sunday, 24th of January, as the former president spent his first weekend out of office, plotting revenge against those he says betrayed him. Stewing over election defeat by Joe Biden 4 days after leaving the White House, Donald Trump continued to drop hints of creating a new political party, a threat some saw as a gambit to keep wavering senators in line ahead of the opening of his trial in the week after 8th of February. Democrats will send a single article impeachment to the Senate for a reading on Monday evening. It alleges incitement of insurrection regarding the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol that left 5 people dead, including a police officer. Donald Trump spent the weekend at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, splitting rounds of golf with discussions about maintaining relevance and influence and how to unseat Republicans deemed to have crossed him, according to a report by The Washington Post. Trump, The Washington Post said, had said the threat of starting a MAGA or Make America Great Again political party or a Patriot Party gave him leverage to prevent senators voting to convict, which could lead to him being prevented from seeking office again. Later on Sunday, the New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman cited sources familiar with Trump's thinking when she said Trump was backing off his threat to create a new political party, after it was gently pointed out to him that threatening a third party while simultaneously threatening primaries makes no sense. Nonetheless, those in Donald Trump's crosshairs include Liz Cheney, the number 3 House Republican, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, and others who declined to embrace false claims of election fraud or accused Donald Trump of inciting the Capitol riot. Other senior Republican clashed on Sunday over Donald Trump's trial and the party's future. Mitt Romney, the Utah senator and former presidential candidate, and a fierce critic of Donald Trump, who was the only Republican to vote for impeachment at his first trial last year, said the former president had exhibited a continuous pattern of trying to corrupt elections. Mitt Romney said, "He fired up a crowd, encouraging them to march on the Capitol at the time that the Congress was carrying out its constitutional responsibility to certify the election." Speaking to CNN's State of the Union program, Mitt Romney said, "These allegations are very serious. They haven't been defended yet by the president. He deserves a chance to have that heard, but it's important for us to go through the normal justice process and for there to be resolution." Mitt Romney said it was constitutional to hold a trial for a president who has left office. "I believe that what is being alleged and what we saw, which is incitement to insurrection, is an impeachable offense. If not, what is?" Romney, however, said he did not support action against Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. Republican senators who supported Donald Trump's claim of a rigged election and objected to results of the election. Mitt Romney said, "I think history will provide a measure of judgment with regards to those that continue to spread the lie that the former president began with, as well as the voters in our respective communities," he said. "I don't think the Senate needs to take action." Other Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska, are expected to vote to convict Donald Trump. But the party is deeply fractured. For a conviction, 17 Republicans would need to vote with the 50 Democrats. It is unclear if that number can be reached, despite assertions from Minority Leader Mitch McConnell that the mob was fed lies by Donald Trump. New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman said that Donald Trump had started to believe there are fewer votes to convict than there would have been if the vote had been held almost immediately after the 6th of January riot. Marco Rubio of Florida said he thought the trial was stupid and counterproductive. "We already have a flaming fire in this country, and it's like taking a bunch of gasoline and pouring it on top of the fire," Rubio told Fox News Channel on Sunday. Senator Rubio added, "I look back in time, for example, Richard Nixon, who had clearly committed crimes and wrongdoing. In hindsight, I think we would all agree that President Ford's pardon was important for the country to be able to move forward. I think this is going to be really bad for the country. It's just going to stir up even more and make it even harder to get things done." Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas threatened retaliation, tweeting, "If it's a good idea to impeach and try former presidents, what about former Democratic presidents when Republicans get the majority in 2022? Think about it and let's do what is best for the country." Mike Rounds of South Dakota said he believed the impeachment was unconstitutional, telling NBC's Meet the Press, "The U.S. Constitution specifically pointed out that you can impeach the president, and it does not indicate that you can impeach someone who is not in office. So I think it's a moot point. But for right now, there are other things we'd rather be working on. The Biden administration would love more of the cabinet in place, and there's a number of Republicans that feel the same way. We should allow this president the opportunity to form his cabinet and get that in place as quickly as possible." Republican unity appeared increasingly rare. On Saturday, 23rd of January, the Arizona Republican Party voted to censure Cindy McCain, the widow of the former senator and presidential candidate John McCain, and two other prominent party members who have crossed Donald Trump. The actions drew swift praise from the former president, who backed Kelly Ward, the firebrand Arizona State Party chairwoman, who was the architect of the censure and who recently won a narrow re-election. Donald Trump, according to a Washington Post report, called Kelly Ward to offer his complete and total endorsement.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing the Maribor Uprising, directed by Maple Raza and Milton Gillen. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him is Maurice McLeod, who is a social commentator and director of Media Diversified. He is also the vice chair of social policy research organization Race on the Agenda. Now, the Maribor Uprising shows how in the once prosperous industrial city of Maribor, which is Slovenia's second largest city, anger over political corruption turned into a revolt against the mayor, the violent police forces, and the corrupt political elite. This documentary places audiences in the midst of the uprising as crowds surround and ransack the city hall under a hailstorm of tear gas canisters. The Maribor Uprising raises many questions faced by these events and by the uprisings elsewhere, from the Arab Spring through Paris to Black Lives Matter.
When we watched the images from the protests of the Arab Spring, Greece and Occupy, we were certain that nothing like that could happen here. That is, until they installed the new stationary radar system which sent speeding tickets right to your home, 70,000 in the first weeks of operation. Then we found out that 90% of the proceeds went to a private contractor, not to our city. Then we learned the mayor had close ties to the private contractor. Then we heard he was running for the National Council, which would give him immunity from prosecution. Then we heard where this was happening, and we went there to stop it. Twice we went into the streets. Twice the police drove us away. Twice the news media embedded behind police lines portrayed us all as hooligans and criminals.
We formed a video collective because things looked very different on our side of the police lines. All the footage in this documentary is shot by people like me, people like you. I invite you to join us as we record a new uprising, the third uprising, organized on Facebook and called for tonight. You'll decide how you participate.
Will you stay here and film with the people fighting to hold the square? Or do you go to record those who are seeking safety further to the south?
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So we're in this show, we're reviewing the theatrical version of the documentary. It was initially screened as an interactive film, which gave the audience a chance to make decisions throughout the film. And Mike, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that there are two different versions of this film, and I think the version that we saw is an imperfect version in that, you know, it has the rough edges that I would associate with activist and collective-derived filmmaking, the rough edges that I think the filmmakers would say authenticizes that the action.
Would you say that by the style of the filmmaking and
yeah,
that it's done with smartphones? And
exactly, yeah. It's shot on the fly and, you know, there's no sort of calculated camera movements, any of the sort of slickness that you would get with more commercially-minded documentary, I think. There's something missing in terms of what we actually get, in terms of what the protesters are protesting against, I think. We get mentioned very early on a certain amount of public money being spent on radar systems. Beyond that, there's a kind of generalized dissatisfaction and grumbling with the administration. So maybe that was all addressed in the interactive version. We didn't get that. What it has and what really is its strength is the sense of absolutely being caught up in the middle of something. And in the middle of something that I think is sort of quite localized. We've seen a lot of films about protest movements in the last few years, things like We Are Many, about the Iraq War, the protests against that, The Square, about the Arab Spring, Maidan, Ukraine, but they're all big epic movies. This is much more localized. It feels like the kind of protest that you and your friends could organize, or that you and your friends could, you know, rock up to on a Saturday afternoon and participate in, and that's a strength of the film, I think.
So do you think this film serves as a valuable tool for audiences who haven't experienced the protests firsthand?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is one of the reasons why it exists in several forms. It's a very good point of entry, I think, for people who haven't necessarily been on many protests and maybe coming to a protest for the first time, but do feel they have got something to say and something to share. And it shows you all the avenues you can go down in the course of one afternoon or one evening's protest.
And Marie, sorry, if I could turn to you now. As someone who advocates for racial equality and justice, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I found it interesting. Like you say, it was very bitty, but that was its nature and that's how it should be. It very much felt like you were in the protest, and I thought we didn't get the full interactive side of things, but I that really felt like you were making decisions and you were in amongst it. There were bits, like you say, there were bits missing for me. I would like to have known a little bit more. I think if it were made commercially or whatever, there'd be a bit more about the history, a bit more about how they got into that situation. And yes, you understood that there was corruption and that people were feeling aggrieved, but I thought there could have been a little bit more to show how they ended up in the protest, because one of the big points they made was that people didn't expect the police to behave so violently, that it was a prosperous city and people were kind of used to, since 1991, at the end of Yugoslavia, they'd had their independence and freedom, they felt very empowered, and suddenly, well, maybe not suddenly, but as the corruption became more and more obvious, the protests grew and ended up pretty violent. I thought that was gathered quite well. So you felt very much like, well, why is this happening? And but maybe with a bit more background from before, you would have got that a bit more. I felt like that was missing a little bit. And sort of you were plonked right into the middle of it, and it's like, okay, you know,
you're figuring things out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That was intentional.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Which I guess, if it were a real protest, you know, that's exactly what happened. You're like, well, do I want to go down there?
There's a lot of moral questions and there's lots to grapple with. And I think perhaps the abstract and philosophical nature of the documentary is a credit to it, and that's the kind of questions it raises. So we really get the sense of desperation and a sense of urgency for their need and want for change in the country. And we also get the sense that nothing has changed for a really long time, and he even suggests that something more radical needs to be done. Mike, I know Maurice mentioned that there isn't a lot of political context, but is there something, there's a need for these people to drive out to the streets?
Yes, I mean, very early on there's a quote where one of the protesters says, you know, we detected this growing chasm between what we want and what the world around us is. And so the entire film becomes a sort of disquisition into, well, how do you fix that gap? How do you bridge that gap? And one of the ways is to look around at the people around you, and they start looking out to one another and making their own images. Now, the protests that we see here come at a very crucial time in Maribor's history. We learned that they've just been named European City of Culture. It's often the case that these big moments tend to sort of focus a lot of energy in this way. I was thinking sort of the run-up to the 2012 Olympics in London. There was a lot of unrest before that. There were protests before the 2016 Olympics in Rio. What we're dealing with here is a contrast between the official version of events, the image that the authorities want to show to the world, and what the people actually on the street are seeing in their day-to-day reality. And one of the ways you bridge that gap is by making your own images. And this is exactly, I think, what this film is doing. It's showing you the images, the reality, as seen by people on the streets who just weren't happy with the image the authorities were projecting outwards to the world.
And Maurice, would you agree with what Mike said? And do you think there's universal aspects to this protest?
I think there are very universal aspects to the protest. I would add to what you're saying, in that this was the third protest, and as they said in the trailer, the other two protests had been, you know, filmed by the standard media, and they felt that they weren't representing what was actually going on. So people took control and made their own media. That's great. That's the way forward. And the universality of that is that's what happens now in protest. It's no longer is it, well, let's see what the BBC are saying about, you know, our protest. People get on and do it themselves, and we have the ability now to do that. Maybe not as joined up as a documentary like this, but you know, most protests now, if I were watching a protest, I would go online and I'd watch someone who was there, and I rather than watching the sanitized version, or the version that we know is spun to some extent. So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in let's get our own message across. Let's film our own stuff. Let's show our own images and tell our own stories. That's universal, and that's certainly came across, I thought.
Well, that's a really good point.
I knew that people went into the streets in Cairo, Athens, Paris and Ferguson for such different reasons. But when I watch their footage, it still reminds me of our experience. I mean, in each city, it was the reaction of the police that turned protests into uprisings.
And Mike, what can you tell us about the way the police are portrayed?
Well, it, for all the sort of rough edges of the film, in many ways, it's a very classical three-act narrative. So the first act is getting people out on the streets. The second act is what then happens once all these people are out on the streets. How do you control that mass of people? And there's, very early on, a fear amongst the protesters that there might be some kind of violent action. I was surprised, actually, that there are one or two clips where you actually see the policemen liaising with the protesters and coming over to the protesters and saying, can you just tone it down a bit? Which, you know, I think if a film was determined to demonise the police force, they wouldn't have those little clips in. But at the same time, we do see a good deal of violent action like that. And as the narrative says, you know, these are the actions that turn a protest into an uprising and have this sort of violent reaction. So I think it achieves a balance. You do get a sense of, you know, the immense amount of fear on both sides, I think, once huge amounts of people take to the streets.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, but I was getting this impression that the filmmakers had a sense of betrayal and shock by the police force. They expected them to be the people's protector, but then they suddenly turned on them and suppressed their voices. What did you make of this?
Yeah, there was a very specific moment, wasn't it, where the narrator said that they came under attack, and it surprised them that they reacted exactly the same as the other protesters and started defending themselves. And she talks about love and the barricades. And, you know, you look at the person next to you, if they, you know, you're being pelted with tear gas or whatever, and they pick up a tear gas and throw it back, it's a very natural thing. You feel very, connected to the people next to you, and that really came across. It didn't feel at all, it didn't feel like an objective view of what was going on. It's like, this is from inside, this is what we're seeing, and that really came across, I felt. But yeah, the police violence, I mean, as a lot of the people interviewed said, that's what really made this into a major protest, because it sounded like people were kind of disgruntled and were cross with the mayor, and then the police reacted in a very strong way, which shocked everyone, which made a counter reaction, which is often the case, isn't it? It's often, I mean, look at Catalonia or something, it's often the case that the way authorities deal with what could be, you know, perfectly reasonable protests ends up sparking something quite bigger.
So we see this in lots of protests, mass protests, Black Lives Matter, the Arab Spring, etc. Mike, did you want to add something?
Well, there's a visual contrast in the film as well, because we're getting lots of different opinions from the protesters. they're a very diverse lot, whereas when we see the police, they're all there dressed alike, they're all in uniform, they're all lined up together, moving forward silently. They become this kind of anonymous threat. And that's a very sort of effective little tool in the middle, going on in the middle of the film.
It would have been nice, I thought, maybe in the interactive part this happens somewhere. It'd been nice to have seen more from the police, because there was a bit that I saw where a protester said to, was trying to converse with a police officer, he says, take your helmet off, come and talk to us. And I'd like to have seen more of that, because those police surely work and live in the area, or I'm always interested in what makes the authority figure, who's still a human, look at someone that one of their fellow citizens, and think, no, you're violent and I'm going to hit you. How can we bridge that gap? I'd like to have seen more from the police side of things.
You mentioned violence. I want to touch on that issue, because I think one of the questions the film raises is this issue of peaceful, artful protest versus violent protest. Where do you weigh in on this debate?
Yeah, it's a constant thing, isn't it, to be honest? Whenever there's, when Ferguson happens, it's like, well, they've got a right to protest, but they haven't got a right to throw anything. And I feel like in my work, I'm constantly defending people's right to protest, and sometimes those protests get carried away because emotions are high and, actions and reactions, like we've just said. I can understand. I thought the film did it quite well when it asked the question. It didn't say, violence, of course this should happen. It said, what's the difference between this person and that person? You went that way and they went that way, and they got caught up and threw a tear gas canister back and you didn't. So it tried to make a link, I think, between the protesters, whether they were violent or not violent. I thought that was kind of interesting, quite a brave thing to do for a documentary.
No, very clever.
It opens them up to criticism, I would imagine.
So it's not black and white, it's a complex issue with different layers.
A few days after the third uprising, the one we helped film, Mayor Kungler resigned and a candidate associated with the protests was elected mayor. Across Slovenia, 50 other towns organized uprisings under the slogan Gotovi so, they're finished. The prime minister was swept up in a corruption scandal of his own, his coalition government collapsed, and he was voted out of power. So the initial demands of the uprisings were met, even exceeded.
So after all of that, it seems as though the protests didn't really work. Mike, are you convinced they had an impact?
Well, this is the surprise third act. We're talking about a three-act structure. Generally, these kind of protest movies end with some kind of flag-waving triumph, some sort of great note of hope that the audience can carry away with them. And what happens here is that the protesters meet their aims, but they do so in a way that they don't necessarily expect, and that's the big surprise of the film. So it's not this triumph, it is more of a sort of score draw that sort of they muddle through it. And what you get a sense of is the filmmakers trying to preserve everything that they've learned in the course of the journey, in the course of the protest, so that future protesters can come out and see the film and have a sense of, well, you don't win every time. Sometimes you win in a way that you don't expect. Sometimes, it's that old thing about life being the thing that happens when you're busy making plans. And this is absolutely reflected in the film.
And Maurice, what do you think of this sort of ending towards of the documentary?
I thought it was successful, even though, not much changed in the lives of the protesters. I mean, that's the thing that leaves you thinking, well, what was it for? But as they said, they achieved all of their goals. Maybe their goals were too short term, changing a mayor and removing the radar cameras. And
some of it seems a bit superficial, some of the changes, like a political reshuffle.
Yeah.
Do you think the film therefore has a wider message about lack of trust in the political establishment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that was evident that they, as the woman was saying there, they replaced corrupt leaders with other corrupt leaders. But I felt that And I thought that the documentary did mention this, that's not the only point of the protest. It's also, it brought people together, it showed that they actually do have some agency and can affect change, even if it's only on a superficial level. There was someone talking about the social, community-type change that they felt had happened since the protest, that people felt more engaged with each other's lives and more involved. Someone's talking about family history that they started discussing since the protest. So I think that that sort of stuff often gets ignored. You go, did you win or did you not win? You know, something just in coming together is important.
It's about, you know, I think we've been schooled to expect instant gratification. And I think one of the things that the film shows is that you can't have an easy win all the time. Sometimes it's a cumulative effect of small victories that build up to something that lasts, that's worthwhile. And I think that's the kind of victory that happens here.
Mm. And what other kind of wider lessons can we learn from this documentary, do you think, on the act of protest? Especially at a time like now, this political climate where we see protests constantly.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I watched it thinking, what can I learn about protest? I don't know. I think it asks you questions. I think that's more what the document is. It says to you, what do you think about this? What do you think about violence? What do you think about this? What would make you uprise? Do you think this could happen? All those sorts of questions are really pertinent. I watched it and it made me explore thoughts that I was already having about protests and stuff. That's all very good, and it made me think about it from a context which I had no real connection to. I had no real connection to Maribor, and I had no real knowledge of their protests. So it was good looking at it from, you know, clearing out the emotion that maybe is in some of the protests that I do get involved in, like the Black Lives Matter stuff, clearing away some of that and going, okay, in this instance, this is how it happened. And like she said, I was amazed by how much it still felt very similar. It felt very familiar, and the reactions and the anger of the crowd, all of that is exactly the same. So I felt it did a very good job at getting that across. I don't feel like it was offering a judgment on protest. I don't feel like that was the point of it. I think it was more, I know, the anatomy of a protest, or, you know, it was more explaining how it developed and ended up.
That's really interesting. So it's open to interpretation and it's relative to everyone's experience. And Mike, final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
Certainly. I mean, I would very much now like to go and do the interactive version so I could sort of negotiate my way through the situation as it developed and see how things changed and how it changed my opinion as well. But as a starting point, it's well worth seeing.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave a comment and your thoughts regarding our show. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.